This is the Medicast, August 6th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 78. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome you to this podcast. For all of you long-term listeners, I want to thank you for your contributions, your comments, your corrections, everything you've done to make the Medicast what I think is one of the best darn EMS podcasts that are out there. Okay, maybe that's a little bit much chest thumping, but anyway, I'm happy with how the show's going, and I'm happy and seem to be getting good comments from everybody coming in, and that's a positive thing. If you're a brand new listener, head on over to medicast.com. You can check out past episodes there. If you're subscribing via iTunes, of course, you can check out past episodes by downloading the other episodes that are in your browser window there. Either way, show notes with links to everything I talk about are available over at medicast.com, as well as other stories that I find throughout the week that I post up there on the blog, as well as links for the show notes for the Medicast News, the midweek short format podcast that I do. I think, though, that I should jump right on in and touch base with some of the listener email and comments that I got this week. First off, a comment from listener John. John's a student from California, and he wanted to just let me know he enjoys the podcast, but he was listening to last week's show and heard the comments on Coumadin when I touched on that as the med of the week. And he just wanted to remind me to point out that there are interactions between other medications that are important to keep in our mind with Coumadin. And you know, John, you're absolutely right. Coumadin is a blood thinner. Anything that is going to have that effect of thinning the blood is going to be something that you want to watch out for. Aspirin, naproxen, and other H2 receptor antagonists like cimetidine or ranitidine are also things that may interact negatively with Coumadin. And so we need to keep that in mind and remember to understand what's going on in the bigger picture. Try to get a handle on through a good medical history on what's been going on with the patient recently. John also points out that if you've had an unusual amount of recent physical exercise, this will cause you to metabolize Coumadin at a faster rate, resulting in thinner blood. And again, this can all lead to increased danger of internal bleeding that is not evident immediately when you check it out. So, John, I want to thank you for your comments. Good luck on the show, listening to the podcast. I'm glad you're downloading past episodes, and good luck with your studies coming up this fall. If you have any more comments or questions, don't hesitate to send them my way. I want to thank Chris Black and several other people who had some suggestions for EKG software in response to listener Woody's question from last week's episode. And you want to check the blog this week. I will be putting up a post with those suggestions and some other things that I turned up on how you can get some refresher time on learning to recognize, identify, and treat different arrhythmias that you run across in the field. So thanks a lot to everyone that pitched in comments and response to Woody's question. Okay, well, seeing as how we're moving right along here, I think it's time to jump into a little bit of this week's news. What do you think? First of all, there's a story I found that talks about a new product or feature called Detailed 911. Detailed 911 is being tried out in a service in the San Ramon Valley of California. And what they've done is they've set up services with an internet company in the East Bay area. And what they're doing is setting up an online disaster registry that would, for a fee, store residents' personal details. Now, of course, we'd have to figure out whether people are willing to pay for this service. It's going to be about $2.20 a month per phone line to register name, address, details, disabilities, medications, and other personal information. But I think for a certain segment of our population, such as parents of children with long-term illness issues, special needs people of other types in the community, as well as our elderly patients, wouldn't it be great to get a heads up on a patient on your way to the call? You know, a current list of allergies, or, you know, a list of the patient's medical issues as of the time it was last reported. All of these things are available using this service. And I know that there are services like this that are integrated in some of the patient care reporting software that's out there that remembers patients that have been handled in the past and call up their current medical information, much like hospitals do when we go to check in a patient at the emergency department. So it'll be interesting to see if this service takes off. It's something to keep an eye on and something that kind of is something I'm going to be watching for the future. Moving along, a few weeks ago, I touched on diabetes as the tip and trick of the week and also discussed some of the issues surrounding the drug Avandia with regards to its possible deleterious effect on increased risk of heart attack in patients that are taking the drug. And there has been a lot of discussion. There's been several reports or studies that have been done that have shown that there doesn't appear to be any positive factors that increase length of life or quality of life for diabetic patients that take this drug, and in fact may even be an increased problem with heart disease that is, of course, already an issue with patients that have diabetes. So I thought it was important to point out that I've found a story this week that is coming out talking about a non-binding recommendation by the Food and Drug Administration panel that is a government health advisory group. And what they have said, based on a 22-1 vote, that they think that it is not a good idea at this time to go to what they call the, quote, draconian action, end quote, of removing Avandia from the marketplace when there seem to be some significant weaknesses and inadequacies in the studies that seem to point to a problem. Interestingly enough, the panel did have a vote that said that the drug does seem to increase heart risks. This vote was held at a vote of 20-3, and they want to have the FDA include a so-called black box warning for the drug's labeling. Now, this black box warning is kind of the last step of warning that falls below the actual removal of the drug from the marketplace. The black box warning would flag the risk that there seems to be some increased heart risks associated with the use of this drug. So there's going to be some more information coming down. This advisory panel, as I said, offers non-binding suggestions to the FDA, but I think often these recommendations are followed because that's the purpose of this advisory board. So we'll have to see how this shakes out. But again, it's important for us to educate ourselves because we may receive questions from patients involving the use of this medication. And we should be educated to the fact that there have been some pointers towards increased heart risk, but that ultimately the patient needs to confer with their primary care physician and make a decision based on the whole picture involved. They may be on Avandia because they are unable to take other medications to treat their diabetes, or Avandia may be having a positive effect for that particular patient. Again, these things all need to be looked at carefully and are best handled by the primary care physician. And our best recourse is always to point the patient back to their doctor and give them the knowledge to ask the right questions to get the good care that they need. Speaking of those with increased heart risks, I found a study that looked at the efficacy of defibrillators, the implanted defibrillators, and providing the needed shocks for patients with a genetic heart disease called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or HCM. A group of these patients were studied who received implanted defibrillators. And in the study of 506 patients who were at high risk and had been given the implanted defibrillators, one in five did in fact receive shocks that were likely to have saved their lives. However, another 27% of the patients claimed to receive unnecessary shocks from their devices, and several of them seem to have developed dangerous side effects, such as infections following the implantation, also hemorrhaging or blood clots, and mechanical problems with the device in actually 7% of the cases. In one of the patients, they were actually killed by a faulty device. Now, it's interesting to see any of us who've been in the back with a patient who's having their implanted defibrillator go off as a result of a mechanical problem or firing for apparently no good reason can attest to the fact that this is disturbing, to say the least. It's painful for the patient. And for us as providers, there's not a whole lot we can do about it. We've got to get them to the emergency room where the doctors have the necessary tools to shut off the device pending the implantation of another one, if that is indeed what is warranted. So again, just something to keep in mind, and you can check out the rest of the story looking at the need for implanting such devices and making sure that the devices in fact work as they are intended. Finally, I'll wrap up with a story that has to do with some of the toughest things we deal with as emergency services providers, and that's the death of an infant. When anybody who ends up being in a situation where you have an infant who's died from SIDS, or sudden infant death syndrome, this is one of the most difficult calls that any of us may be asked to jump in on. And it's hard on us as providers. It's hard, of course, on the families of these children who have died. And so I'm heartened to find that a study seems to suggest that it might be possible to screen newborns for SIDS risk using a simple hearing test. Now, this is important because if we can screen children who are at risk for SIDS, it may be possible by giving them certain monitors and things when they're put down for naps or for sleep at night, it may be possible for us to alleviate the onset of respiratory arrest that is believed to be the cause of SIDS. So, in other words, an alarm would go off alerting a caregiver to go in and resuscitate the child, and while we might be called to the scene to initiate transport, this patient is a live baby patient and not a dead baby patient. In any case, as the final story this week, I think it's important for us to talk a little bit more about this subject, so I'm going to make this our tip and trick of the week for this week. Sudden infant death syndrome, one of the toughest topics in EMS. I'm going to include a link to the Medline service of the National Institutes of Health link for the SIDS link in the show notes this week. It's really a page that is just a clearinghouse of a ton of information, information for parents, information for providers, research, everything else, all right there. And you can pretty much, I think, find, based on the links they have right on that page, anything you might want to know about SIDS. So you can head on over and check that out in the show notes after the episode is all finished and done. But first of all, we need to look at what SIDS is and what SIDS is not. It is the major cause of death for infants 1 month to 1 year of age, with most often the deaths occurring around 2 to 4 months. It is sudden, as the name would imply, and it's silent. There seems to be no underlying problem or risk factors, and there is no definitive idea over exactly what causes this sudden infant death. It's often associated with sleep, and there are no signs of abuse or suffering. It is an officially recognized disorder, and it can only be determined after an autopsy, examination of the scene of the death, and a review of the infant's and the family's histories. And this is important because even though a crime has not occurred, you want to preserve the scene as much as possible because it is an unexplained death of a child and it does need to be investigated. And by leaving the scene as untouched as possible in your carrying out of care, you will enable the people investigating the situation to help determine the cause of death. The infant death will leave many unanswered questions and is really a cause of intense grief for parents and families. These are not children of abuse. These are children in loving, caring families who have died for unknown reason. Out of the blue, a seemingly healthy child has died, and this causes an extreme stress to the family and to us as providers as well. SIDS at the current time is not preventable, but there are some things, key tips, that you can do as a parent to avoid the risk for SIDS, or at least reduce the risk for SIDS. And these are things I'm going to put up on the show notes as the tip for the newsletter subscribers, and later this week I'll have it as a post on the website at medicast.com. It is not caused by suffocation. It is not caused by vomiting, choking, or minor illnesses. It is also not caused by vaccines or immunizations. This is another one of those internet rumors that is causing parents to refuse to vaccinate their babies against life-threatening illnesses because they believe the vaccine might cause SIDS. SIDS is not contagious, and it is also not the cause of every unexpected infant death, hence my belief that we need to preserve the scene of the child's death as a crime scene until determined otherwise. Doesn't mean we treat the people around it as a crime scene, but we want to make sure we don't disturb anything any more than is necessary. What we do find, though, that it most often occurs quickly and during sleep. It's rare during the first month of life, but it can occur in older infants. But as I said earlier, it most often happens during between the months of 2 and 4 months of age. There seems to be more common frequency in boys than in girls. And it seems that racial characteristics also come into play, with a 2 or 3 times greater likelihood in African American and American Indian infants. It's important when you come upon a baby that's a suspected SIDS death that you follow whatever your protocol is for resuscitation of infants that are apparently, in all likelihood, already dead. And I don't treat this lightly, but you may come upon a baby that has significant lividity and presence of rigor mortis. And you need to make sure you know what your protocols say about initiating CPR on infants in this situation. And it may be best that you remove the child from the scene, initiate or seem to initiate CPR to alleviate some of the family's concerns, get out to your ambulance and follow and contact medical control and police agency to continue what needs to be done, which is investigate further on what happened. That's just my own take on this. You can talk to your supervisors and the people that you work with on how they may have dealt with this in the past. Again, this is an extremely sudden and awful situation for a family. Deaths of children will force family members to confront mortality in an extreme sense, because babies are not supposed to die. And so, like any sudden death, a SIDS death will leave a family with a supreme sense of shock, loss, and an urgent need to understand what's happened. You can alleviate some of this, not by any means all of it or much of it, by being honest, straightforward, caring, and understanding. You may even want to allow the parent, if the child has been declared dead or pronounced by you in the field with the assistance of medical control, you certainly, with your attendant's presence, allow the parent to hold the child. This is something that they need to do. They need to say goodbye. They need to understand what's happened. Even though it's tragic and we're going to be investigating the scene and reviewing patient history, doesn't mean that we shouldn't recognize the grief that this causes to the family. As I said earlier, there's nothing that can be done at this time to prevent SIDS, but there have been some initiatives that have decrease the risk for SIDS in patients. One of them is the American Academy of Pediatrics Back to Sleep campaign, where they urged parents to place their infants on their backs to sleep rather than on their stomachs. And this began in April of 1992. This has had a significant effect in reducing the number of SIDS death. Between 1992 and 98, infants who slept on their stomachs decreased from more than 70% to only about 20%, a significant decrease, especially when viewed that during the same time frame, the number of SIDS deaths in the country declined by more than 40%. So most researchers and professionals agree that putting an infant to sleep on their back is one of the most significant ways to reduce risk for SIDS. Now, this is not to say that a parent that places their baby on their stomach in order to help them sleep is and has a baby die from SIDS is at fault, because this is not the only thing that seems to be in play here. And we need to be careful of placing blame or discussing this around a parent of a SIDS baby. But it is something we can do in our communities to decrease the risk of SIDS and decrease our having to respond to such a call. Other things that may be associated risk factors include exposure to cigarette smoke, overheating of the baby, because babies' inability to control their own body temperatures efficiently by overwrapping them and providing them too much in the form of clothing and blankets may cause an increased problem with their temperature regulation. And finally, there is some more research going on regarding the type of bedding that infants use. In any case, you want to make sure that you be involved in your community. If you're one of those providers that has chosen to go out and talk to community groups, one of the topics you can discuss is how to prevent SIDS. You can talk about this in babysitting classes that you may teach. If you teach CPR to teenagers, this is something that we can start early. Teach people about putting babies to sleep on their backs, about overheating, about the other risk factors for SIDS, and help them to understand that we can't prevent SIDS, and none of these things is a guaranteed way to stop this syndrome from occurring, but it is certainly a way that can reduce the risk for such. So I think I'll leave it go at that. Again, check in later this week for some tips and things that I found on SIDS. I'll be putting some more up on the website. And if you're subscribed to the Medicast newsletter when this show was published, some of these tips will show up as your tip of the week in your newsletter tips. So in any case, I think I'll leave it at that. And that's this week's tip of the week. Okay, moving along from that particular topic, I will now move into this week's Med of the Week. And I thought I'd look at another medication that we might come upon in certain patient populations and not really understand specifically what the medication is and does. So I'm going to look at the medication methadone. We see methadone most commonly in our population of IV drug abusers who are using methadone as a way to counteract their cravings for heroin or other narcotics that they may have become addicted to. Methadone is a narcotic pain reliever that is similar to morphine in some of its characteristics, but it also is known to reduce withdrawal symptoms in people that are addicted to heroin and other narcotics without causing the high associated with the drug addiction. It can also, of course, as I said, be used as a pain reliever and as part of a detox and maintenance program for drug addicts. So what do we need to know about methadone? Well, methadone is a drug that, if it's taken like any other narcotic, can have serious side effects and cause death. So even if you're used to using narcotics as pain relievers or have a patient that is an IV drug abuser, methadone can cause serious side effects. And in fact, I've actually come upon a patient recently that was presenting as a drug overdose. He was apneic and for no other apparent reason, decided that it might be drug-related, administered intranasal Narcan, and began to get a response within a few minutes after the administration. It turned out this gentleman had a back pain issue and had ended up going home with somebody from a bar. And when he went home with this particular woman, he didn't have his pain medication. And in the middle of the night, he got up, found this girl's methadone pills because she was a recovering drug abuser. And he took some of her methadone, not knowing its potency, not knowing how many milligrams to take, and ended up snowing himself with narcotics. He was used to taking ibuprofen for his back pain and thought this would just knock the edge off and help him sleep. Well, it helped him sleep all right. So methadone does have similar side effects. It is a relative of morphine, after all, and will be something to keep an eye on if someone does overdose on their methadone. So what side effects are we looking for? Well, of course, any medication may cause side effects such as allergic reaction. So these things are always something to watch out for. But primarily, we're going to be looking for shallow breathing or apnea, hallucinations, confusion, anything that may indicate altered mental status. Also may cause heart palpitations, including tachycardia, and of course chest pain and dyspnea associated with chest pain. Other side effects that may occur include anxiousness, problems sleeping, dizziness, drowsiness, or general weakness, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, and impotence or a decreased sex drive. But also important to understand is that medications and other substances will have effects on people taking methadone and cause an increased presence of side effects. Anything that's a central nervous system depressant, like alcohol, could multiply effects with methadone, as well as things like Valium or other benzos may be taken in concurrence. Of course, anybody that's taking methadone that has a history of prior drug use, you're going to want to make sure that you ask them when they've taken the drug and whether they may have taken anything else that may be having a negative effect on their methadone levels and side effects that might be present. So methadone is a drug that's usually taken orally. Patients that you encounter will have a supply of the drug. If you're curious about it, you can just tell them you need to write some information off the bottle. You can then check the bottle, find out when it was filled, how many tablets were in the bottle when it was filled, and you can get an idea if they're on target for their next prescription refill. Have they taken the drug as advised? Is the pill bottle nearly empty and it's only a week old? These are all things that you can kind of investigate a little bit if you suspect a methadone overdose or another issue. Anyway, just a quick overview of methadone. I know there's a little bit more that can be said about it, but I think this kind of touches on the facts and the understanding of the medication that we might need in the field. And you can check out the links in the show notes for other information as you see fit. And I think that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the Medicast. Wow, it's 33 minutes, so this is a little bit of a shorter episode by about 10 or 15 minutes than I usually do. And I guess I'm rushing through this because as you are listening to this, most likely I am on vacation with my family. So I recorded this ahead of time and threw some things together at the very end of the week to make sure I had something for you guys while I was away. I will be back in the saddle again next week, as always, with another episode of the Medicast. In the meantime, head on over to medicast.com. Check out the blog. Even though I'm away, I have already scheduled things to be landing on the webpage. So I will be having blog posts magically appear as if I was actually sitting here at home doing all the research and things that I do normally. So make sure you check out the website and check out the blog posts and links and things that show up there so that you can continue educating yourself about what's going on out there in EMS. If you'd like to contact me, you can do so by email, by emailing me at podmedic@mac.com. You can also reach me on the Medicast voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. And if you're listening on an iPod device that has a screen on it, you can click on the center menu button, actually the center select button a couple of times. It'll actually bring up a description of the show, and the phone number is included in there every time as well. So if you're driving along and you're like, hey, I need to talk to Jamie, this is something, he said something, it's driving me nuts. Well, you can find the phone number wherever you are if you have your iPod with you, and you can call into the show. I'd love to hear from you, and you get your comments played here on the show as well. Include your email address at the very end of your comments. Don't worry, I'll clip it off, but that way I can get back to you if I have any questions or need clarification. And those are some of the ways you can contact me here. You can also always leave comments over at the website at medicast.com. Every single one of the blog posts, the show notes entries, and everything else have a link at the bottom where you can leave a comment. Go ahead and sign in, leave a comment, and if it's your first time posting, I'll have to approve the comment before it can be posted. But after that first time, you can go ahead and leave comments anytime you want, and they should show up almost immediately. So that's how to get in touch with me here at the show. If you haven't already done so, make sure you check out the Medicast newsletter. If you aren't subscribed, you can click the link in the upper right-hand corner for the Medicast newsletter. Fill out the form and send it in, and you can get signed up to receive the links for the show notes sent to you every week right to your email address. And that's a great way for you to know when the show's been posted, and a great way for you to have all the links right there on your computer right away. So sign up for the Medicast newsletter now, and it's a great way for you to also get an extra tip and trick every week, because I always throw an extra tip at the end of the newsletter as a way for you to improve your practice as a paramedic or EMT, or as a way to provide you information to use when you reach out to your community in your efforts to prevent disease and traumatic injury as well. Okay, enough of the business end of things. I would like to thank all of you for listening to this show, as always, and want to make sure you all are staying safe out there. And I'm going to wrap up, as I always do, with some excellent PodSafe music this week from a band I've played before called Brain Bucket. And it's a song called I Know What I Know. And I think that's important for all of us to keep in our thoughts as we go through our jobs and travels this week. We do know what we know. We are trained medical providers, and we need to sometimes just rely on our instincts. We know what we know. We know what we see. And until we find out evidence to the contrary, we need to go with our gut and treat patients to the best of our ability. All right, so enough of that. I'm going to leave you with Brain Bucket and I Know What I Know. I'm Jamie Davis, the pod medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.
We all need love to keep on going. And if it's what you just don't show.